This is Publishing Talks, a podcast about books, authors, and publishing. I'm David Wilk, your host. Today I'm talking to an old friend, Tom Montag. He's a poet, he's a writer, he's been a publisher, an editor, a teacher in a lot of different places, and I consider him a really good friend. How are you, Tom?
I'm doing well. It's a little warm today, though.
Well, I think wherever, you know, it's warm in most of the country, and probably uncomfortably warm in a lot of places.
Yes.
So
it's 99 here today.
So you're in Wisconsin, Fairwater, Wisconsin.
Correct.
Maybe for all of those who are listening who may not know where you are in that state, which is a fairly big place, maybe you could kind of pinpoint your location.
We are about an hour and a half northwest of Milwaukee, or an hour and 15 minutes northeast of Madison, about 25 miles southwest of Oshkosh.
My gosh. And how long have you been how long have you been living there?
We have lived here since 1976. September of 76.
And before that, you were in Milwaukee, as I recall.
Correct, yes.
So what got you to go from what was then the 10th largest city in America to a small town in the northern part of Wisconsin?
Well, I grew up on a farm in Iowa, and Milwaukee is not at all like a farm in Iowa. my wife's parents had a summer place in Marquette County, Wisconsin, which is about 40 miles northwest of us. And in 76, with two daughters, we decided, well, if we're going to make a move, let's do it before they get too far into school. So we looked around on a line towards the farm because it's part of our regular route, so we wanted to be going closer to that rather than farther away. My wife was a nurse, and she found a job opportunity in Ripon, Wisconsin, which is 8 miles north of us. And so we started looking in the area for a house, and we stopped into Action Realty in Ripon and saw a picture of this big old gray battleship of a house that was in our price range, being, you know, poor church mouse poet people. So we said, where's Fairwater? We came down here, and having lived too long in the city, we didn't know you come in the garage door, so we came to the front door. And from the front door, we could see brand new varnished wooden floors facing a brand new varnished built-in wood oak hutch. And the sun was streaming. Of course, they had the curtains open. The sun was streaming in the window, and it won our hearts.
So you've been there ever since?
We've been there ever since. Well, I've told my wife, you know, when I die, just bulldoze the house in around me and and let that be it.
Well, it sounds like you've like a lot of people think about this, but you've actually done it, which is to find a home. And
yes,
I think that's, you know, that kind of says something about you as a person. I think it helps understand you as a poet as well.
I think you're right.
Yeah. I think when we first crossed paths, you were in Milwaukee, you were editing a magazine called Margins that that you started, as I recall. And how long did Margins go as a magazine?
72 to 76. And then Mary and I moved, and the girls moved up here, and I didn't realize how much support system I had in Milwaukee that I lost up here. I had two people typesetting for me and all that sort of stuff. And the workload by myself just became overwhelming. So It failed in 76. The last issue was published, I think, in 76, and that was it.
Yeah, so what prompted you? What was the impulse for starting a magazine, at the time you did?
Well, the only people who were reviewing books, the small press books that I was interested in, was Small Press Review, Len Fulton in Paradise, California. And I thought there was room for more discussion than that of this wave of new work that was coming out. We started out as legal size stapled together in the corner newsletter format sort of thing, and then and by the third issue we started having it printed on newsprint magazine format, and a typical issue was 80 pages, and we did some triple issues of 316 pages and that sort of thing before it was done. Carl Jung was involved as an associate editor and started the, what did he call the series, symposiums. Michael McClure, Rochelle Owens, and people like that would have a big spread of people talking about their work. So it became larger than just individual reviews of small press books, but something bigger than that. And I think it made a mark. People talked to me about remembering margins and how much it meant to them back then. So
yeah, well, I feel that way. I think it was, I think a lot of the magazine output of that era had a big impact. I think there, we as editors and, publishers of magazines and independent books were communicating with each other, and there was a pretty big community. I mean, obviously, very diverse, not always in agreement, not always in accord, but...
Disagreement is good, I think.
Yeah. Oh, no, I thought it was...
Respectful disagreement.
Correct. And it was not always respectful. There were some characters who were not. But overall, I think it was a really powerful... I look back on it as having had a major impact, not just on me, but on a lot of... on the culture in general, in a lot of ways that sort of reflect, all the arts and cultural... forms of that period, how they've come into the present. It being around for 6 or 7 years as a magazine is, when you're doing it kind of off the cuff without a whole lot of support, it is really hard to do. I mean, I think it's an achievement. And I admire the magazines that were able to continue for longer periods of time. But I also think that there's a value in existing while you provide a purpose and fit into the culture in a certain way. And then if it's okay to stop, when whatever, for whatever reason, whether the moment changes or the person changes, it kind of makes, it creates some kind of a meaningful endpoint too.
Right, right. Part of my problem was, the magazine was too successful. If you have 800 subscriptions to Zip Sort and pack and bundle and package and take to the post office, that's one thing. But all of a sudden we had 2,800, and that got to be way too much to for Mary and I to handle by ourselves. We were not set up for success, and that's there's a reason that small press is small, so that one person or two people, a few people, can make it happen. If it becomes large, then it's more than those people can handle. So it's finding the balance point between, you know, what's doable and what's thrivable. And I went beyond that, I guess, at that point.
Well, but you, yeah, it's, I think that makes sense. It, you know, is like more, you know, some, you need to have a structure when you get to be a certain size or a certain level of success. I of course, I, as a publisher, I've never had that problem. So I don't know what it looks like, but I can tell from other people's experiences that it, you know, it causes people to build structures, you know, that then out and potentially outlast them and, you know, bring in all kinds of issues on them on their own. Like, as we know from our friends at Woodland Pattern, a very successful literary center in Milwaukee, but it required them to bring in a lot of resources to connect with a lot of people to become part of the community in a really big way, that a small literary magazine would have trouble doing that.
Right. It's interesting you mentioned Woodland Pattern. I think it's tangentially connected to what I was doing with Margins. Carl Jung and I had Bamboo Scroll bookstore. We hired Carl Gartung to manage that. And when Bamboo Scroll went out of business, then Carl Gartung started up what became Woodland Pattern. So, you know, and now they have retired. Carl and Ann have retired from that Woodland Pattern. And it continues beyond them. That's a, you know, they were able to go into another generation. I couldn't even get through my own.
Right. Well, and there are a number, you know, there are magazines and presses that have done that, like Coffee House and all these, a lot of, you know, institutionally connected magazines are mm-hmm. able to then continue on and become independent of the original, of the founders.
Correct. Yeah.
But in a lot of ways, what you did is reflective of the more, you know, the magazine or press as an continuation of the writing work. You know, it's more low level, less structural, less, it doesn't require being funded on a large scale, and sort of, it, you know, kind of makes sense that it comes, you know, that you create something, it exists for a while, and then you move on.
It's interesting. When I was doing Margins, I wrote virtually no poetry. I wrote what became my book of essays and reviews, Concerns, as part of that whole experience, but not very much poetry during that time. So that was a downside when you throw yourself whole hog into something like that, then it's at the expense of something else. In terms of, my wife says I'm allergic to money. So Margins could have been a success had I had the energy to continue it, the energy and the fire. Mary and I started the Wisconsin Poets Calendar in 1980 and published it in 82, 83, and 84. I guess we started it in 81. And it got large enough to be too much for two people to handle on an ongoing basis. And I handed it over to the Wisconsin Fellowship of Poets, who continue it, but they rotate the editorship. They have one person who's the business manager. They have a rotating distribution group and that sort of thing. So they're equipped for something that can be successful.
Yeah, well, it kind of makes sense. I mean, if you want to be, I mean, in your case, to be, I presume the writing is really the primary interest. And if being an editor and a publisher is going to prevent you from writing, then that's something that eventually will have to give way.
If I don't write for a while, I tend to get pretty cranky, and we don't like that. So at some point, the other stuff has to get out of the way and let me write. On the other hand, I have continued as a publisher. Wednesday, I got the newest book from the printer, Local News, an anthology of poetry about small towns. I have been packaging contributors' copies and getting them in the mail these past 2 days. So that work goes on as well.
So how many books are you publishing each year?
Two this year. It's small publishing. It's what I can handle. You don't want to have more books come out than you can wrap and put in the mail to send out.
Man, it's a lot of work to put books in the mail and send them out. It's probably, people underestimate how much work that is.
Yes.
And so, Ed, how do you, what's the imprint now? What's that called?
MWPH Books. Before that, it was Midwestern Writers Publishing House. And before that, it was, what was it? Monday Morning Press.
Oh, yeah, right.
So it goes all the way back to like 1972 in some iteration or other. I did some mimeographed or Xerox books under Fairwater Editions and some other things as well. But the main one now is MWPH Books.
So all in all, when you add it up, have you ever counted how many books you've published in the last 40 some, almost 50 years?
A couple of years ago, I was invited to speak about small publishing at a book festival in Fox City's book festival in Appleton. And what I could find easily without, you know, going into the far reaches of the attic, one copy of each thing, not including any of the literary magazines, filled up a large shopping bag that I took up and spread out for people to see. So consider a large shopping bag and how many things might fit into that.
Well, it depends on whether you're, you know, well, I guess how strong you are in terms of carrying a shopping bag. So, but that's, yeah, it's a fair number of books.
I would say 50,
yeah,
60 maybe. I'm talking about folded broadsides and chat books and small books and fat books and, you know, everything.
Has anybody ever made a checklist, you know, a kind of historical record of everything that you've published?
Call me. I'll work with you if you want to do that, somebody.
I think it's a good idea. I think that it would be, interesting. Probably, You could find a library, a graduate student in library science, you know, make that a part of their master's degree or something.
That would be nice. I have my archives go to the University of Wisconsin La Crosse Special Collections in the Murphy Library there. And they have done a checklist of the stuff in the archives, but I don't have everything there yet.
As a poet, you've been pretty prolific. I was looking online before we talked, and I think even one of the websites I found, which was fairly old, from, you know, maybe 10 or 15 years ago, you had a pretty extensive list of publications. How many books of yours have been published?
Oh, Willikers. Well, the ones I count, the big ones I count are Middle Ground, The Big Book of Ben Zan, In This Place, and 70 at 70. And then there are several chapbooks. you know, small Ben Zen chat books before the big book, and my first publication was a chat book called Measures. So all told, with the big books and the small ephemeral, more ephemeral things, probably 15. But that includes four or five books of prose as well.
Yep. That's a lot.
Creative nonfiction and criticism, reviews, that sort of thing.
Yeah, well, that's a pretty significant output of books, I think.
Yeah, sometimes it doesn't seem like much, and sometimes thinking about it wears me out.
Well, you write all the time, and not everything you write is going into a book.
That's true. In this place, it was selected from 1982 to 2013, and the pile of manuscripts that I chose from was reduced by 2/3 to go into the what actually went into the book. So that many didn't make the cut.
Right. So let me ask you this. I think this is an important question, at least for me. I'm not sure. I don't know whether this is a universal question among or issue that writers cope with. But when you're going through stuff that you've done, like the choice of what you think should be in a selection is not just about whether it's good or not, whether you like it or not, but it's how it fits the ethos or the collection's kind of rolling imperative. And I'm just curious how you put together, how do you work when you're selecting homes to go into a collection? What are the rules you follow, or the measures that you use in order to make a decision?
With 70 at 70, which just came out a couple of months ago, 70 poems at age 70, what I did was figure out the structure, and I'm a pretty simple person when it comes to structure. So 70 poems is 4 by 13 plus 2, isn't it? Doesn't that work out to 70? So I had 4 13, so I needed 4 poems of winter, 13 poems of winter, 13 poems of spring, of summer, of fall, a prologue poem, and a postscript poem to make 70 at 70. So if you weren't a poem some way related to the one of the seasons, you were automatically excluded. And then how did the poems for winter fit? So they got arranged and shuffled until it was right, and some didn't make the cut, and then go on to the next one and the next one and so on, which was somewhat different than my collection, selection in this place, which spanned, 82 to 92, 2002, 12, 30, 31 years, a broad band of work. So I found categories and grouped stuff into categories. And then there was stuff that, you know, Mary would say, well, you said that already up here. So, you know, you have to start thinking about leaving some of the repetition out. So, and then I like things that have a flow, and if something didn't fit the flow, it had to go out. So I broke it into sections. Each section had to have some kind of feel, and that established itself and automatically excluded certain things. So that's the sort of way I structure.
So do you, after you've put a book together, a collection like that, I mean, do you ever... do you feel that anything that you've left out should have been put back in? I mean, should have been included, but there just wasn't room for it? Or are you generally it's sort of, okay, I did this, I'm moving on to the next thing then.
I'm okay with the way things have turned out. I very seldom have regrets.
That's good. Well, I guess I don't mean regrets so much as second thoughts. Like sometimes I find if I read a poem today and I like it, and then I read a poem, the same poem tomorrow, I have a completely different feeling about it. And so it's sometimes you wonder about making decisions, especially about your own work, whether, whether you're able to be as clear about it as you really want to be.
Well, that's true. I don't think you can be. You do your best blindly and push on. At least that's my... And the other thing is, you know, there are sometimes, well, maybe it'll be in the next book. There are people who do that, that a poem written into the 70s doesn't get published until the first book in the 90s. That's not the end of the world.
That's true. Well, assuming, as we know, as you get older, you have less comfort in the future, or less belief in the future. So the poem delayed may not be ever... brought back, may never appear.
Well, I have a plan for that. I have been putting up one poem a day on my blog, The Middle Westerner, must be since 2008. So multiply 2008 times 365 to get us to 2019. I've put that many poems up on my blog, and I have put for the past 4 years a poem every day up on Facebook. No, not that long. Last 2 years, maybe a poem every day up on Facebook. So they exist in the ether, irrespective of whether I'm dead or alive.
Oh, I think that's that's brilliant.
Wayback machine, and many of these have not been published in books. So, some of them will be.
Right, but it doesn't...
I hope to do.
Yeah, but this is a great way to ensure that they have they're alive. They're
right.
Available. They're in a place. I think the notionality, actually what you are maybe just suggesting is the collection has a value of its own. It's a way... It's another expression of the... create, of the work is how it gets, how things are selected and put together into what we call a book is meaningful. But it's also important on some level to show everything, it's sort of like, well, you show everything, you're showing all your cards.
Right.
That, which is an interesting thing, because I think that up until the advent of, let's say, the blog or, the online publishing platforms, that was just not possible. The poets, writers of all kinds are constrained by commercial considerations, by structural considerations. The idea of a book, the format of a book, the way a book is made is all based on manufacturing process.
The meat world. And at this point, we don't need the meat world. We can get it up in the ether world.
Yeah.
The special thing about doing a book as opposed to putting a poem up on a blog, a poem goes up on the blog as its own thing. Whatever it is, it is. But you put 70 poems next to each other in some kind of order in a book, they talk to each other.
That's right.
So they become, each poem becomes larger than itself in the context of the other poems. And that's the beauty of bringing things together in a book.
Yep, I agree.
For me.
No, I agree. I think that we are accustomed to that notion of context, of contextuality, and it does have meaning for us. I would venture to say that at some stage in human history, if we continue along the path of kind of undifferentiated creation where the physical form no longer has the same power or necessity, that it does today, that you might find that that will change. But I think for this period of time, the context is actually very valuable.
Yes. I don't think it's that the book context culture thing is going to disappear before I do. But at some point, well, who knows what's going to happen?
Yeah.
300 years from now.
Yeah, we don't know. I mean, it could be all of this electronic digital publishing stuff disappears and is replaced by handwriting on the side, you know, on the walls of caves again. We don't, you know, we don't know.
That's a thought.
So earlier, you reminded me of something that I wanted to talk about when you mentioned the name of your blog, The Midwesterner. I think your identity as a Midwestern poet, writer, editor, teacher, publisher is really important. It's part of your being. You know, you're connected to place because you've lived in the same place for so long, but you're also connected to the place, the larger notion of what the Midwest is, maybe of what, you know, the kind of territory that you've lived in, grew up in Iowa, lived in Wisconsin, not that far away. So maybe you could talk a little bit about how place and the Midwest actually does mean, what it means to you, how you express that in a variety of ways.
For some years, 2005, 2006, 2007, I was traveling to the 12 Middle Western states, as I call them, specific towns I had picked out as meant to be representative of those. And I've interviewed about 175 people over the course of that, and I would start out asking three basic questions. Why are you here? Was the first question. I can't remember what the second one was. The third one was, do you have three or four adjectives to describe the people of this community? And the shortest interview was 45 minutes, and the longest was 4 hours, just with those three questions going in. And it was as if people had been waiting all their life for someone to ask. And one of the first things I learned was in the Midwest is food is love, or love is food, or they will feed you. if they like you, they will feed you. So that's one of the things that I can say. But that doesn't speak to place so much as growing up on a farm and seeing the cycle of life and death, birth and rebirth, the change of the seasons, the turn of the year, all of those things create a structure which is larger than the poet himself and gives the poet something on which to hang his notions of the world and his experience of the world. And I'm not sure that I didn't grow up in a city, or in tract houses, so I can't speak to that experience. But here I have a structure to the universe that informs my relationship to it. And that's wonderful if you're a poet and have built into you a way of looking at the world. Writing is not so much a matter of imagining, but of seeing, of simply seeing what's there in front of you. My relationship to place, I think, lets me do that.
Do you think that the, I think I know the answer to this, but I really would love for you to address it, that the place, the nature of the place affects the language, the expression, the form of speech in the poem, not just of the people that live there, but of the way that you write. Do you feel that's accurate to say?
If my dad were a poet, his poems would sound exactly like what I'm saying, because I learned to speak from him. And I've put this in a essay somewhere, I think. We were painting the barn, and the tax assessor comes to see you improving your thing so he can raise the taxes on your property. And he tried to make small talk, and he said, "We were up on the ladder." He's down there, and he tries to make small talk, and he says to my dad, "Do you think it'll rain?" And my dad said, "It'll be a hell of a long dry spell if it don't." That's poetry, and that's what I want my poems to do. You know, and my Ben Zen, the Oriental monk traveling modern-day America, could meet a Iowa farmer, and they would talk for hours. They would understand each other.
You think? Well, they speak the same language on some level. Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Without pretense and trying to see clearly and close to the earth, those are things the farmer has, and I think the things my Zen monk had.
Well, what, if you can, aside from your father and the people that you listened to when you were young and growing up on the farm, what other, you know, I mean, obviously you've read lots of things, but maybe who are the poets that in the context of being a Midwestern person, a Midwestern writer, who are the poets that kind of speak to you the most deeply?
Well, I'm going to have to kick myself. I would say Robert Creeley and William Carlos Williams have taught me the most, but a poet like William Clefcorn from Nebraska, Ted Kooser, Mark Vins, are people who showed me that that we can speak about this place in meaningful ways. And they showed me that we can inhabit other people and speak in their voices, which was a revelation to me that I didn't have to be myself. I could be some of these people that I didn't want to see disappear into the void. I wanted to speak for them. So I have series of poems in other people's voices that let me keep a sense of the world other than my own alive as well.
Do you kind of try to meditate yourself into their being so you can speak in their voice? I mean, isn't that a form you have to do, a kind of careful listening in order to be able to quiet your own mind to let them through?
In my experience, they have overpowered me for a time. And although I wrote poems in my own voice, when I was hearing them, I knew it. The Ben Zen poems, Iowa Farmer poems, Civil War poems, Mary DePrairie, Pioneer Widow Woman poems, those voices were distinct to me. Sometimes Tom would say something, okay, and then I would say, "Oh, that's a Ben Zen. I better write that down," because I realized that wasn't me saying it. It was Ben saying that. So it's a matter of listening to the words and to the tone and the voice and, you know, where is this coming from? But none of it is anything I called up. I didn't imagine it into being. It wrestled me until I dealt with it.
Mm. So do you sort of feel like, does it fit the model that I think of Jack Spicer and the poet as dictating the, the voice that comes from somewhere else and comes through?
He said that we're radios receiving whatever's coming in on the ether.
Yeah.
And I am somewhat of a, yeah.
Yeah.
If you pay attention, it will approach you that way.
I talk about this all the time, that the great Cocteau film, Orfeu, where the poet is, he's in a junkyard in Paris, tuning a radio in a dead car and writing the poems. That is literally, literally the image that Spicer, I think he must have seen that movie too. That's the image. It's that you're tuning in the radio and hearing it, and you've got to get it down before you lose the station.
Yes. But in another sense, I think as a poet writing what I would call quote unquote my own poems, it becomes a matter of listening to the world around you. What are the trees saying? What are the stones saying? What is the brook saying? What are the birds saying? And there is something beyond me in them that I can tune into and record that.
Yep. Well, I agree. I think that is the act. I think it is that act of listening is the kind of critical moment. And it's so hard to listen without, when I think of, of Buddhist meditation, where they talk about quieting the mind and stopping the noise. And I think that's an important concept. And it's funny, you talk about Ben Zen. I think it's really, I feel that character is working on that concept.
I think you're right. I think, I think if we learn to see, learn to listen, then the world will come to us. I had a Cheyenne friend who talked about calling in the antelope. So you would sit down and call in the antelope, and it would approach you and let you kill it from your sitting position. We need to be able to face the world that way. It's interesting, just the other day, 2 days ago, I put up on my blog the poem, The Essence of What Can We Learn from Silence? We can learn to listen. So, that's a huge, learning to listen is a wonderful thing, a huge thing.
Oh, it is. I think it's actually, it's crucial in every way, because it's so difficult in a noisy world to hear. So listening becomes a real necessity. I think it is. I'm really glad you said that. I love that piece. I think that's really, it's like a little koan to think about and roll around in your mind over and over again till it becomes meaningful.
Well, until you learn it.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Well, Tom, we could do this for a long time. We'll have to do it another time again. It's really been fun to talk. I think really good for me to hear your voice and hear more about what you have to say. So,
well, thank you so much. This is, I very seldom know what I'm what I think until I say it. So this has been an opportunity for me to learn what I think, and I appreciate that.
Well, it's good. It's good for me too. I get to learn what you think and hear your wisdom, which I think is pretty important. So thank you.
Thank you.
This has been Publishing Talks, a podcast about books, authors, and publishing. I'm David Wilk, your host. I've been talking to Tom Montag, who's in Fairwater, Wisconsin, at 99 degrees. Thanks, Tom.